accession number 23378, reel 12.
Interview with Phil Roden in his home in Melbourne, Victoria, on the 15th of the 5th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Phil, you wanted to talk about Owen's Corner. Owen's Corner. And the way people would come up and look at the track. Tell us that story, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, as the war developed and the understanding became a feature of Australian political life, there were people wanting to have a look at the place. Short of going over the track itself, which would have been pretty impossible for them to do and too risky, they'd come as far as Owen's Corner, which is 26 miles at the end of the road from Moresby. You stand there and look over the mountains which rose up in serried steps, clouds clipping the tops of the mountains. That's all you could see. And you were told there the Iron Stanleys, and it's over there that the fighting has gone. That's where the track starts off, which is just a bit of a native pad worn down by native feet, nothing more, nothing less. And it goes down about 50 yards away, it disappears. Now they're showing this and they go back to where they've come from, whether it be divisional headquarters, Moresby itself, New Guinea Force headquarters, or land headquarters, or American headquarters, Curtin, or anywhere else. So they say, oh yes, I've seen the Iron Stanley, dreadful place, you know. Very little effort made to understand, or so it appeared to us. There'd be some genuine people around that take it, not that they didn't take it serious, it's hard to make a judgment on people at this distance from the event, but it appeared to us at the time that there was a bit of insincerity around the place. Insincerity. You can easily get a jaundiced view when you're at the cutting edge of things.
We'd spoken about, I've read, the exhausted Potts is relieved on the 10th of September. Porter takes his place and establishes a line at Yorubawa on the 12th of September. 2 days later, the 25th Brigade arrive. Horry and the Japanese are in sight of the main goal at this stage, and they fall on the remains of the 21st Brigade. Were you involved in that incident?
Yes, at Yorubawa, we reached there around about the 12th of September, I suppose, from coming back along the track. We occupied a forward slope, and it was sad. But every time the mountain gun opened up, somebody would get wounded or was killed. I resolved there and then that I'd never be caught. Not that we were caught, we were there of our own volition. And it was the proper place to be at the time, tactically. But it's a hell of a place to be when you've got nothing to answer back with. And it was sad that people that had endured so much and survived so much since the 12th of, or the 4th of August, when we set out from Brisbane, should be killed at this very last moment. I was very much affected by it because good fellows went at the very last moment. It was good to see the 25th move through, as they did. They looked good, and they turned out to be good. And we were surprised to hear that Ether, the commander of the 25th Brigade, had decided to adjust his position backwards. This caused great consternation in New Guinea Force headquarters, divisional headquarters, and of course the police went mad. MacArthur went mad. And the final edict went out to Ether. Yes, you may do it. This is the last withdrawal to take place. If there's any more, you don't come back alive. In other words, it's the finish, chum. These are serious times. Anyways, we well know that they started off towards the end of the month to make their advance, and the Japs were gone. It was a mixture of, I believe, well, I know it was a mixture of casualties, suffering the same supply difficulties as we had suffered. They had expected to get to Moresby within about 12 days. They took only rations for that amount of time. And they didn't seem to have any availability to resupply. They were bringing their sick and wounded forward to Moresby, thinking they'd get there and open up their own hospitals, so they had them to think of, and they were becoming very cluttered. And then there was the added problem of Guadalcanal. So I felt that Moresby had then become expendable in view of what was going on at Guadalcanal. So it was a mixture of difficulties with the operation over there in Stanley's.
At the time, what were your feelings in relation to the closeness that you were to Port Moresby, and what was your understanding of the situation?
Well, we knew that something was coming up the track from Port Moresby, but at one stage in September, early September, the 25th Brigade were only just on the water between Australia and Moresby. So it was a matter of hours between us and the Japs breaking through. Hours. Not days. Not months. Hours. And if they'd followed through aggressively, as I hinted they didn't earlier on, the day would have been up. To find people to agree with me on this, they say, oh no, it was well in hand. But it was ours. I think if you took down, sat down and created a bit of a chart as to where everyone was, you'd see that that was more or less so. But we were grateful for small mercies to see them come through. We potted about there for a little while before we moved back to Koitaki, where we refitted. Got our spirits back, wrote letters. Little military work was done. And then in October it was decided to form a force from 21 Brigade, a company of strength from each battalion, to be commanded by Major Challen, the brigade major that took over from me, to form a force which would harass the enemy, to be used by 25 Brigade headquarters and then 16 Brigade headquarters, who followed up for 25 Brigade in October. That force consisted of fellows volunteering to go back and do it again. When Challen went to command that force, I then became acting commander of the battalion again. And illness beset the force. They were used in tasks which were important, but not too much fighting, and as for being a harassing force, they didn't get much opportunity to do that. Mainly, I think, this is only my own guess, because of the difficulties the brigade commanders to encompass the use of a force which is fairly independent of their own brigade setup. It was an extra effort which they were not prepared to encompass, I believe. But they did a good job. But they suffered sickness to a great degree. They were there as a force when we went into Goma.
Prior to this, you mentioned the realisation that the Japanese had pulled back. When were you aware of that, and what was the response when you realised what?
We were at Koiteki when we heard that they'd moved forward and found nobody at home. We were amazed and pleased, of course. Nevertheless, on reflection, we felt that they were hoisted with their own petard. Supply difficulties. Things that we were criticised for that befell on them. So it was a victory in a funny way.
There is that situation in relation to Potts's position and how he was eventually relieved and...
We felt it vindicated Potsy a bit, the fact that they were not there. It didn't stand him in very good stead there. Sad occasion. They don't mess about when they start, you'll go in the morning and the plane's ready for you. Or if he goes to Darwin.
Was it simply just a situation where people didn't understand the difficulties that Potts was faced with? People talk of the scapegoat.
When a force loses in a war, somebody's going to be made to pay. It's a consequence of losing. And no amount of representation can alter the fact that somebody's got to go. Somebody else be given a chance. But nobody would listen to Potsy. Nobody wanted to know the difficulties he was fighting under because they themselves, higher up the scale, the Guinea Force headquarters, Blamey, MacArthur, Curtin, Minister for the Army Ford, were all under pressure of various kinds from those people above them. They too were appalled at the fact that it was a near miss by the Japanese. They had to make a new effort, a new try. It was only natural, I suppose, but it was unjustified in Potsy's case. He fell because of the inadequacies of others above him. Got a new commander called Ivan Doherty. He was a great man, and he was with us until the end of the war. He had his difficulties in settling into a Potsy-oriented brigade, but he did it with the help of people.
The comments that Blamey was to make, do you recall those?
I do.
What do you recall of the words that he spoke?
The words as recorded are true. He knew what he was doing. He felt he had to do it, I believe, to exercise, to show to his superiors, MacArthur and the like, he was taking some action in regard to what they termed a debacle. I remember being on parade and getting in. We had expected to be praised on the brigade parade. The whole brigade was there. 14th, 16th and 27th. The divisional commander had been down a fortnight earlier, Tabby Allen, and he'd praised us. We knew we'd done a good job under the circumstances. Breathing space has been gained. Then he launched into this, it's only the people that run, the rabbits that run, that get hurt. And I felt the fellows had marched on the parade wonderfully well, their bearing was great, their spirit was good. All of a sudden I thought a movement behind me of troops, you know, a swaying in the ranks. And I took a glance backwards. I said, well, they're going to move. They were so incensed. They didn't move, to their credit, physically. They were moved up here. But Carl Lyon, blame his ADC. Thought this was one of the mistakes Blamey had made and criticising the brigade that had done so well. He says that in his book, I Knew Blamey, I don't know whether you've read it. He indicates in his book that Blamey cried on the way home to Moresby. My reply to that, I'd like to see that. But if you look at it from the perspective of a commander of Blamey's standing, his responsibilities to his government and to the free world, the Australian people, he had to do something. And he did what he thought was the correct thing under the circumstances. He spoke to a separate meeting of all the officers, some of whom refused to go. And he spoke in similar terms. Not fit to command such gallant troops. We'd agree with the gallant part, but not with the other part. But there's, in every situation that's critical, there was always right and wrong. We were all very upset. To Blamey credit, later on at Ravenshoe on the Tablelands, between the end of the Battle of the Beachhead and early 43, and going off to the Ramu Valley, he tried to square things up a bit. And in the Ramu Valley himself, he came up to see us before Christmas, the end of 1943, and I was CO of the unit. He came up in his jeep, standing up with his hat blowing back in the breeze, stopped and said, "G'day, Roden." I said, "G'day, sir." He said, "How's the battalion?" And I told him, and they performed very well. He said, "Oh, they're a good battalion, you know." He tried to square off in his abstract way. It wasn't a direct, you know, "I'm sorry about it." He didn't say sorry, like they want everyone to say sorry these days. But nevertheless, I thought Blamey to be a good commander. Unfortunate.
It must have been very difficult to take, given that you'd left close comrade behind.
It was very difficult to take, and it was very difficult for the troops to take. They'd lost their mates. We had a big job to round things off by talking and explaining and that where their duty lay, not to do anything silly. It was a ticklish situation. They were hurt. We all were hurt. It was unexpected.
In what way were you able to round things off?
Well, we'd walk into a group in a tent, and as we did, moving around and trying to We were councillors, not officers, in the Finnish for a while. Like every day now, if something happens, you've got to have a councillor. We didn't know the trade at all. We were starting from scratch. But the best thing is to know what's in the fellow's mind and talk it through with him. We used to do that, just sit down and casually talk. It inevitably come around to blaming. We try to explain why it might have happened. And explain that nobody believed it to him to be accurate in his comments. And that we only had one duty, and that was to keep on fighting well for Australia, not to let it affect us, no matter how much it hurt. And good unity, yet that sort of story, so that's how it happened. It didn't happen overnight. It took a while. Kona was an evidence of bitterness over the urge to get into battle quickly and show that you were on the job at doing things without proper reconnaissance and so on. It took a while to get it out of the system.
We can talk about that. In relation to the relaxation period, you mentioned writing letters home to your people. What were some of the things that you were to write?
Well, take the case of Johnny Clements, who was killed, an officer of Subaltern. His father was in the 1st 14th. His father was pleased as punch that he was posted to the 2nd 14th. He had a deep love of the 1st 14th. He used to come up to Pakapanyo when we were there. And I wrote to old man Clements, he was still alive at the time, pointed out that Johnny had died a gallant death, and he had. He was a good officer. And gave him some comfort, as he said in his reply. That sort of thing. There were others you didn't know so well, but you knew that by checking that they'd done their job and done it well. He perhaps pointed out that it wasn't just a war which we were fighting, it was a fighting for survival. Something to make them feel that the sacrifices ought not to be in vain. To try and bring some comfort to the next of kin. It was an onerous task.
What were you able to write to your family?
My own family.
In relation to what? You've been through in relation to what was going on with you?
I don't think I wrote very much. More inquiries about their life. I don't think I tell them about how tough it was or any of that description. I had I've been friendly with Pat for many, many years. School time. And when we went away to the Middle East, some people thought I ought to have been married at the time I left, but I decided it wasn't the proper thing to do, going away. Something I just wasn't. Anyway, I decided when we were leaving Brisbane Wharf to go to New Guinea that I'd write a letter proposing marriage to her. And I just said, "Darling, will you marry me?" I gave it to a wharfie to post. I said, "Hey, Dick, will you post this letter for me?" He said, "Sure, mate." And off it went. I got a reply. Where? Brigade Hill. Somebody brought up some mail. The answer was yes. Just yes. Shoved it in my pocket and didn't think any more about it. Too busy.
How do you think getting that letter helped you continue?
Oh, it helped a great deal, I think. But the chances were fairly remote at that stage.
Often people discuss the thoughts of being married in a wartime situation as a risky scenario to deal with.
I don't think myself, this is how I thought, and Pat was critical of me for thinking that way, but I thought it wasn't fair to her to go away married, not knowing whether I was coming back or what was going to happen, leaving her in a situation in which she wouldn't be cared for. You've got to remember that we're dealing with a society as it was in those days. It was only, it was pretty well shackled, wasn't it? And that's the way I felt, and I thought it just wasn't fair. But realising we're going to New Guinea as we, and things are likely to be just as bad up there, perhaps I ought to become buried in it. That's what I did. No regrets.
So your time of relaxation, short-lived?
At Koitaki, yes. As I say, I was administering command. And we were told on the 29th of, or at least just before the 29th of November, that we were going over to Gona. We had a battalion that was 400 strong about. The strength we took to over the Owen Stanleys was 546. On a scaled-down model. We actually marched out of the first phase of the Owen Stanley campaign with 87 out of the 546. Challen had come back, he was in command. I was second in command. We flew over the Owen Stanleys to Popondetta and marched down to Gaina and almost did the same trick again of marching straight into battle. Of course, we were mowed down a bit. Casualties were pretty high at the time. One officer, the CO of the 2nd 16th, was relieved of his command during the Gona battles because he was saying that things were too hurried and he was losing men unnecessarily. So he was relieved. It was a bitter and not unnecessary, but something that could have been done better with more planning. Japs were occupying entrenched positions and people had survived the horrors of the Owen Stanleys. Suddenly found themselves confronted with a situation which many felt could have been handled better. Still, the spirit survived and they won through in the end.